This is the State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. 50 years ago, Silent Spring changed the way people looked at themselves and at their relationship to the natural world. The book by Rachel Carson chronicled the way in which human technology has damaged the planet. In particular, Carson focused on the pesticide DDT. Widespread use of that chemical targeted mosquito populations and helped stem disease, but DDT also had unintended consequences. It was harmful to wildlife, particularly bald eagles and brown pelicans. The chemical weakened eggshells, hampering the birds' ability to reproduce. Carson imagined a future where birds died out because of the use of DDT and other harmful chemicals, a spring where sunrise was not greeted by the cheerful sound of birds. And so the title, Silent Spring. Carson's book is often credited with leading to the ban on DDT and sparking the modern environmental movement. Historian Linda Lear is a biographer and author of Rachel Carson, Witness for Nature. She's speaking at North Carolina State University tonight, but first she joins us by phone. Welcome, Linda.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Take us back 50 years. That book came out, Silent Spring. What impact did it have? And sort of give us the landscape. What was the world of environmentalism? There was no environmental movement.
No, there was no environmentalism then. There was a conservation movement, which was wise use of natural resources, but there was no environmental movement. And there was very little awareness of what we now would call ecology, that the human and non-human worlds are deeply interconnected, and that if you do something to one part of the world, you're probably going to end up with a repercussion on the other end.
So tell us about the impact when the book came out.
Well, the book came out today in book form. It had already been published in a serial form in The New Yorker in June of 1962. And immediately, as soon as that magazine had published, there was a great interest. There was backlash from chemical industries and lobbies. They tried to stop the publication of the book, actually, and called Carson, a complete junk scientist, that this was all hogwash. But it went into print, and it sold. It was on the bestseller list for 86 weeks. It sold out. It has sold over millions of copies around the world, and it's been translated into, I think, almost every language there is.
Ultimately, DDT was banned in this country and many others, but the book itself didn't call for a ban on DDT, did it?
Exactly. Rachel Carson never called for a ban on DDT. In fact, she believed that all pesticides, including DDT, had their uses, and especially their uses in hampering the spread of insect-borne disease, things like malaria. What she was against was the misuse, the inefficient use of chemical pesticides, these new synthetic pesticides, of which DDT was just the most famous.
And tell us how it was used, because it was really being sprayed not only on crops, it was being sprayed on city blocks, right? I mean, it was just...
Correct. First, there was a plethora of pilots from the war left over, and spray planes had been converted. And so when you mixed DDT in fuel oil, you got this the ability to aerial spray large landscapes. So they would use it against insect-borne pests like the gypsy moth, the spruce budworm, against mosquitoes in coastal areas, and it would float in the air. Of course, if you sprayed it at one point, it wouldn't stay there. It migrated.
Yeah, and so it would get everywhere. And let's be honest, not only was there a lot of surplus airplanes, there was a chemical industry that had been highly employed during the war and was now looking for a way to stay in operation and find domestic peacetime uses for an industry that had built up quite a bit during the war.
Exactly. And the chemical industry was credited, rightly so, with many, many progressive developments out of the war. And so the better living through chemistry, which was one of the slogans, was something that people were accustomed to. When Rachel Carson began to talk about caution and maybe not overusing things, and that the chemicals were toxic, this was really not known. She was considered a very different voice.
Yeah, it's incredible to think back to a time when, as you say, the slogan was better living through chemistry, that science and technology were going to transform the landscape and take away all of our troubles. So along, because now we know better. Now we know that all of these things bear unintended consequences and we need to be careful. But then, Not a quite different story, yet her book was a bestseller. So what was the tension? Did it create an instant kind of polarization? Who was with her and who were her critics?
Yes, I think it did create an instant polarization, and that the political landscape of the controversy is what we translated 50 years later is what we still have. The environmental landscape is a political partisan battleground, and the arguments haven't really changed very much, and neither have the participants.
Tell us a little bit about Rachel Carson herself, her upbringing. She's born in Pennsylvania, right?
She was born outside of Pittsburgh in a very bucolic town, and one of her major experiences was learning about nature and the natural world with her mother, a very important influence. But also the fact that Pittsburgh, she was born in 1907, and Pittsburgh was becoming more and more industrialized, heavy industry, coal and steel. And so her little town upstream was becoming more and more polluted. By the time she left Springdale in 1930, her little town was no longer a bucolic rural village. It was a polluted, grimy, grungy river town.
And she decided to pursue science, which for a woman in the 1930s and in that era was not an easy thing to do.
Correct. And I don't think we should underestimate the sexism that was involved in the reaction to Silent Spring. Women were not in public science. Rachel had made her name as a naturalist, as a wonderful literary writer of three important books on the sea, which had synthesized the marine biology, but hard chemistry, that was a field for men. Physics and chemistry was all about men. And so when Carson comes along without a PhD, a nature writer, without any institutional backing, she's really a sitting pigeon, if you will, for the industry, which is upset about what she might do to their revenues.
Tell us about those earlier books, those books about the sea. They tended to be, and I'm not sure this is a fair characterization, they were less rooted in science and a bit more sentimental and descriptive of the qualities of the sea? No,
I don't think I'd say that. Maybe the first one, Under the Sea Wind, was a little bit more sentimental. It was about a fish's eye view of what it was like under the water. But The Sea Around Us, which was published in 1951 and became a winner of the National Book Award and every other prize that you can think of except the Pulitzer, was very much a synthesis of post-war oceanography. And because of its great success and because it was so beautifully written and written for the public, Carson became sort of the trusted voice of science for the country. She was popularly known. She was widely read. She was heralded in literature circles, but she was also lauded for her synthesis of post-war oceanography.
What happened to her after her and her career after the publication of Silent Spring?
Well, Carson barely was able to finish Silent Spring. In 1960, she was diagnosed with metastasizing breast cancer, and her book was it was a remarkable feat of courage that the book was finished. I've always thought of Carson as a profile in courage because she not only did she write under the most incredibly difficult personal circumstances, but she dared to stand up to power, really all the powers of the day, the industrial military complex, as Eisenhower called it. But she dared to speak out when people wished to silence her. She died only 18 months after Silent Spring was published at age 56, but she had by then testified before Congress. She had made a very important television program with Eric Severide on CBS Reports that amounted to a second printing of Silent Spring because it showed Carson as a very reasonable woman, not a hysteric, not someone who was telling us that we were all going to be doomed, whereas the scientists who were against her came off as kind of raving loonies.
What about DDT? What was its sort of trajectory after that? When was it banned? And now we've got some different ideas about, again, the right use of DDT.
Right. Carson, as I said, never testified or never promoted at all the ban on DDT. She was against its misuse, as all the other synthetic chemicals, and its inefficient use. She thought there were better ways to control pests. But when the time that Carson wrote, DDT was already being phased out by the chemical industry because they saw the proof of Carson's evidence that insects were becoming resistant. And so they were turning to other more toxic chemicals, if you will, that would do the job better. And DDT was really being phased out. When the United States banned the use of DDT, it was always still exported by American companies abroad. In fact, our exports didn't stop until 1985. And DDT has been produced all over the world ever since then until quite recently. I think China just stopped manufacturing and using DDT in the 90s, and as far as I know, India is the only country that is still producing manufacturing DDT, but it was widely available and has been widely available.
And do we know in those places where it was still used if they were more careful about the way they used it and had less harmful side effects?
I'm not really qualified to report on all of that. I do know that when DDT has been used in, for example, third world countries, massively in agriculture for agricultural pests, that the insects then have become resistant, and so it is ineffective as a insecticide against insect-borne disease. But in those places where DDT can be used in confined areas and in places that have not been overly exposed to DDT, because DDT doesn't go away, it's impermeable. It's in the soil, it's in the water, it's in everything. But in those places where it can be controlled in small spaces, it still is effective against insect-borne disease.
What do you think is her legacy, her role in the environmental movement? Was there a movement building at the time that saw her as its leader, or did she actually, in a sense, did that book generate a movement?
I believe that the book generated the movement. I think Rachel Carson inspired the environmental movement because she told us that we were all interconnected. She told us that our bodies were permeable, and she told us that if we put something out in nature, into the natural world, that it could come back to haunt us, that the circles were dynamic. This was all news. The American public did not understand in 1962 that pesticides were poisonous, were toxic. It's quite remarkable. But Carson, I think, should be credited for inspiring it, for raising the public's consciousness about ecology, about the interconnectedness of all life. And in that way, she certainly is the patron saint of the environmental movement.
Have we learned anything? Have there been any? I suppose one is that we are interconnected and permeable. You just said that. So that's certainly a permanent lesson. But in terms of the environmental struggle today, are we any farther ahead, or have we just swapped DDT for other chemicals that have been made?
DDT since? For global warming. It's the same argument. It's the same partisan bickering, I think. But I think we are ahead in the sense that now there are regulatory agencies that do try to control how much is used and what kinds of testing must go on before. I think that there is a democratic movement that has come out of Silent Spring, where the public now feels that it does have a right to know what is being done to the environment and to their health by their government and by other people. So there has been a new dialogue created, and that's something that the modern environmental movement has taken advantage of, so that we are now, at least we have a dialogue.
You're speaking at NC State tonight, and I wonder what role you think students have, and if you think that young people still consider this an important, generally speaking, environmental questions important.
I think young people consider the health of the planet a very important problem and something that they're involved in. I think that universities like NC State have a wonderful role in teaching students about ecology and about natural resources so that they can learn and then take that information and go out. There's a whole new research mode, if you will, that research shouldn't just stay within a university or within a corporation, that the obligation to endure gives us, as Carson would say, the right to know and the right to carry on.
Linda, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Linda Lear is a historian, biographer, and the author of Rachel Carson, Witness for Nature. She's going to be speaking at North Carolina State University at 6:30 in Nelson Hall tonight. For more information, go to ncsu.edu. That's the State of Things for today. You know where to find us, stateofthings.org. The State of Things is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Robin Copley is the technical director. The managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, the broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.